Joy to the world. Here we are on Christmas Day, and we have...
Are we going to sing, Hark the Herald Angels Sing? And oh, come all ye faithful, and the first Noel, and all that stuff.
And we miss you, Merry Christmas.
No, we wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you... And what I want to know this. Why is it a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year? Why isn't it a Happy Christmas and a Merry New Year?
That's sort of like Mother Nature and Old Man Winter.
Perhaps it's both. Anyway, we're delighted that you've chosen to spend this part of your Christmas Day celebration with us. I hope that it's a safe and a sound one.
And it's
a happy
on the
one.
Menu with Anne and Peter Hay.
And we're not going to tell you where we are. you'll find out in a couple of weeks where we were spending the Christmas holiday. And in the meantime, we've assembled an interesting show for you today.
They're sort of celebratory things.
Well, the first one's a little complicated because State College, otherwise known as Happy Valley, Pennsylvania, has been attracting rather a lot of unpleasant news coverage recently. But on the menu was up there recently at the Carnegie Inn and Spa, and we had a wonderful time. And these things will pass. In the meantime, if you have a reason to be in State College, Pennsylvania, Carnegie Inn and Spa is a place to go. If not, make tracks there, because it really is a restful and a fine establishment. And here's the team who talked to us just a few weeks ago.
We're having a group meeting and discussion here because we've had a total experience at the Carnegie Inn and Spa in State College, Pennsylvania. And so we gathered some of the principals together and breaking it down into the different aspects of the experience, the wonderful experience that we had here, starting with the general manager, Sam Glasgow. You've been around hotels for a long time. This one seems to be close to your heart. What is its appeal? Tell us a little bit about this place.
Sure. This hotel really is close to my heart, and I think to many of the people that come here, that work here, our guests that stay with us. It's a charming little hotel that was built in the mid-1990s. We have 21 guest rooms. Two of those rooms are large suites, and each room is individually decorated. And we've recently gone through a major renovation. It just finished up about 3 months ago. And we're really excited about all of that are going on here and that we've done most recently to upgrade the facility.
And it's cozy. And it's, for example, now it's getting a little chillier out. So there are these wonderful roaring fireplaces. And then in the summer, when it's not chilly out and it's getting a little, except it probably doesn't get scorchingly hot because you're really in a woods almost. I mean, it is a woods setting. And then you can eat outdoors. You can congregate on the porch. So you have the best of both worlds, huh?
We really do. When you arrive here, we're literally 2.5 miles from the campus of Penn State University, but you have a feeling that you are isolated in a very secluded place. We're surrounded by a beautiful golf course that's operated by Tofftrees Resort. Our guests have full access to that golf course, and among the many packages we have, we do have some golf packages in addition to spa packages, which you'll hear about a little later in this in the show. But we feel that the location and the different amenities that we can offer are very special. We're hoping that as people hear this, if they're taking a trip in anywhere in the northeastern United States and they're coming through Pennsylvania, we're conveniently located right off of Interstate 80. It's a great destination to come for a day or for 2 or 3 days to enjoy so much of the activities in this beautiful area.
Being modest, because one of the really neatest things about this place is the service. You're quite a team here, very hospitable. Even anybody in the hallways that I don't even know what they do here are really nice and kind. You're a VIP arriving here.
Well, again, it's a small facility. We have a very large staff for a 20-room hotel. I think go out of our way to make the experience something special. Our rates, we've lowered our rates because
that's unbelievable what you told me about the rates.
We've lowered the rates because we want to get the local community, the business people that come to State College, to experience us. We're different than a chain hotel. The chain hotels have many advantages, but we feel we have some advantages that you don't find at a at a chain hotel. And that's why by lowering the rates, we have the ability to get some of those business travelers to stay with us and visit us, and they'll see the unique difference here.
Now, you had a large group meeting last evening, didn't you? And is that a common thing to happen?
It is. A large group for us is 11 or 12 people.
Okay. This looked like a team-building exercise for like about 16 or 18 people. And you could tell they were all enjoying it much more than just being in a conventional Holiday Inn.
Absolutely. And they had a lovely lunch yesterday. They're having lunch today. They had a wonderful dinner last night that lasted probably a nice long time. They made a nice evening of it. So in addition to their team building during the day, they had a team building event at night. So those are things we do.
And don't forget the internet access.
Absolutely. We have wireless internet throughout the hotel. And while we don't have a true business center, we have the ability, if anyone needs any kind of business services, we have the ability to take care of that for them.
And the name, why is it called after Andrew Carnegie?
At one point, Andrew Carnegie owned this land, although at one point, Andrew Carnegie owned most of Pennsylvania.
Exactly.
But that is really the tie. And one of the original owners, who is still one of our owners, had a love of Scotland and love of Andrew Carnegie and what he did for this country. And so that's sort of where it came from when property first opened. One thing that we do pride ourselves on here in the area, and again, you'll hear about it more when Jerry and Lisa talk to you, but our dining, the people come here, the local people come here on a regular basis for not only just special events, but for regular dining that is very different than they find at other locations. And so we think the best of both worlds. We have a great local following that visit with us on a regular basis, and out of towners who come here once a year, twice a year. Our football guests come 8 times a year, and it's their home away from home. And we're very proud and very pleased that we're able to help them when they visit State College.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the food and beverage program by talking to Jerry Jordan, who is the F&B director here.
Good morning.
Good morning. I got your name right, Jerry.
Yes, you did. You didn't call me Larry or Gary.
Or Jeff or anybody, yes. So tell me about this program. Now, it's sort of in an evolution state at this point, right?
Yes, it is. It's constantly changing and growing and being reinvented on a daily, monthly basis with the chef, who is extremely talented. You know, I work very closely with her to help her convey her message throughout. And she's got a real great handle on American with a touch of a continental cuisine. So you're never sure exactly what you're going to get, but you know you're going to get locally sourced things. You're going to get unusual combination. So it's a unique dining experience in Center County.
Yeah. Now what is the mission?
I think our mission here is to create a environment for our guests to get great, interesting food that maybe they would not normally venture out to get.
Another very interesting aspect of the Carnegie Inn is meet you right in the eye as you walk in through the door, because facing you as you enter is a newly constructed, still being filled wine cellar, which was added as part of a recent renovation. And Jerry and I were talking before dinner last night about the fact that he's really trying to build an extraordinarily innovative wine program here. Jerry, a couple of words about that?
It's been an interesting journey with the wine program, being that I'm very new to the industry, but I am a great lover of wines, as so be some of the owners of the company. We're creating a very friendly environment. We're not trying to be wine snobs, but we want to cover a lot of different bases, so that there are some very drinkable and affordable wines on the list, but there are also some unique vintages as well. So,
and you can expect there are going to be some more as well.
Yeah, it's a baby. It's always growing. We're always nurturing it, trying to find different things and unique things. And one of the things that I like to do is to go in the dining room and talk with people and introduce them into different things that they haven't drank before or that they need to try.
Yeah, I think this would be a fun place for a wine club.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something wine that tasting. we've between the chef and I, we've kind of batted around a couple of ideas, and that's something that we're going to do in the future, you know, as we build the collection and we have time to move forward with it.
Well, it was interesting learning that the chef at this place was Lisa Palermo. Since we just came back from Sicily, you understand this, I'm sure, but people don't go anywhere today without being assured that they're going to get good food. Have you noticed that?
Uh-huh. It is becoming more and more of an issue for people.
Yeah, it's called culinary tourism.
Yes, yes.
So, but we already said that we really enjoyed our dinner last night.
Thank you.
I wanted to jump back a little bit with you, Lisa, because you have some interesting background. Originally from here, but you ventured out and you had some interesting experiences. Tell us about California.
Well, when I left State College, I first went to Chicago. From there, I went to Miami and then New York City and then out to California and worked at Palm Springs. To start with out there for Sonny Bono, and then moved on to San Diego.
Uh-huh. And what was it like working with Sonny Bono?
It was a lot of fun.
Was he
we
fun?
Had a lot of fans come in. It was very busy, and he was a great guy to work with.
So, and you were having a great time, but I guess when he died, they closed the operation? Or?
Yeah, it's very sad. We did close
so
the operation.
So unnecessary, yeah.
Yeah, it was horrible, but
moved
on.
I mean, he must have liked the kind of food that you made. Tell us what kind of food you make. I think that Jerry mentioned American with some European influences. Can you tell us more?
Yes, I call it contemporary European. Definitely has French roots in techniques with a twist that a lot of chefs around the country are doing uniquely. I try and use local ingredients when
You've
I can.
Got a lot of good ones, too.
Yes, we do. And seasonal. We have our basic menu, but we also run a menu almost as big with features that change.
Yeah. Now, I mean, the is common in country homes in England or the UK in general. The procedure usually is you go into the library, which is a charming, spacious room, and you sit around and you order cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
And they bring a couple of nibblies and the menu. So you then decide what you're going to have. And then when it's ready, they call you into the dining room.
Yes.
Which is what we did.
Yes, it's a unique experience to be able to go into the library and relax and have the hors d'oeuvres. And it's not a rushed experience. It's an evening. Take your time and enjoy the whole experience.
And I checked out your kitchen. It's very small, but it's very efficient.
It takes a lot of organization. And I have a great crew back there. We get it out the door.
Listeners really love hearing details of food. So some of the things that we had was we had the, let's see, what was it? The tuna carpaccio.
Yes.
Was delicious. And what did Peter have? The crab cake, which is beautiful crab cake.
Yes, we're known for our crab cakes. It's mostly crab, and that's what makes it good. We don't have much filler in there. We serve it with a lemon chive aioli.
And then the beet salad was really good.
Yeah, that's on our feature menu right now. The seasonal beets with toasted almonds and apples and goat cheese.
And then for main course, I love venison. Mm-hmm. And venison was on the menu. Jerry assured me that it was sourced from the golf course. You can't get much more local than that.
Right.
And it was quite delicious. And Ms. Ann, what did you have?
Oh, I had a lamb. Yes, that's what I had. I love lamb. And it was a huge rack. Couldn't even finish it. But it was so delicious. And all these dishes come, of course, with a appropriate sides mm-hmm. on, mm-hmm. you know, on the platter. And I was a boring salad person. I just had the house salad, which was very fresh. Yes, and actually, Peter drank my salad dressing. I hate the secrets like that, Robin. Well, then, of course, this morning, there's breakfast, which is for only the people staying at the hotel. And we had a full breakfast. And then we ventured to the spa. We're going to have Steve Clemens explain. You tell us all about this spa. It's contracted, sort of. How is it?
We actually lease the space from the Carnegie Inn and Spa. We've got a sister property out Aspenwall out in Pittsburgh. So that's where we started about 13 years ago with Eva Kirschbaumer, who's from originally from Hungary.
Yeah.
So we definitely have the European influence and the European roots to all of our services.
And I had the facial, which was a Hungarian facial by an authentic Hungarian, and it was beautiful.
Judith is our Hungarian on site, if you want to call her that. She's been with us since just after we opened. We've been open now since August. So she's our version of Ava here locally in the State College area. So Ava does come usually once a month to twice a month. She tries to come in and actually does services here for some of our guests. So that's a treat that everybody kind of looks forward to when she's going to be in the area.
And Mr. Peter, what did you have?
Mr. Peter had a hot stone massage, because you told me that's what I had the last time I had a massage, which was about 5 years ago, which horrified the masseuse, who nevertheless did an absolutely wonderful job. But it didn't take as long as your facial. I mean, you got the facial to end all facials today. She's positively glowing, listeners. You should be able to see the sound of this.
Now, what are the rules of how you order up your services? I mean, people were coming from the outside. They weren't even staying here, right?
Right. We're people that are hotel guests, and we also have people from the outside community. And we also cater to business travelers as well, sports teams that are in the area. We've had services used by them. So it's all across the board, really, of everybody that uses us. And we've got packages that are available, which are multiple services that you can choose to help you through the day, or you can actually customize and just purchase individuals similar to a la carte like you would at a restaurant menu.
Now, the thing that really is special about Espa Cosmetica is that it's all organic.
We are an organic green spa, right down to our nail polish, which is actually vegan-based.
Really?
Really. So that's what we're known for. I mean, all of the ingredients that are used in our facials are organic. They actually come from Hungary. So that's one of the lines that we use. So, you know, the green spa is definitely forefront for us here in the area.
Well, I mean, there's a whole roster of services, and how do you locate the services on the internet?
We are at www.espa.us, and that's the website that will actually get you here to the country.
ESSPA.
Mm-hmm. And that's the website that will get you right here to the Carnegie Inn.
Great. And then it lists all the services.
All
and
the
then
services.
You make your appointments well in advance, right?
Yes. Yes.
And let's ask Sam just to clear up the confusion and give us a last word, because all the road signs, which are many, coming from Interstate 99, 220 to get here, say Carnegie House. But when you get here, it's called Carnegie Inn. So, Sam, the real name and the real website.
Well, the real name is the Carnegie Inn and Spa. And right now, most of the road signs locally have been changed to Carnegie Inn and Spa. But there's still many of the older signs out there. And the website, there are a number of websites. You can go to the old website, but the new website is Carnegie Inn and Spa, all one word, and it's A-N-D, so it's Carnegie Inn, A-N-D-S-P-A, all one word, .com. Or if you're lazy, just carnegiehouse.com, and that'll get you here too. So, we hope to see all of you stopping by for spa services, for a wonderful meal, for a great overnight, or for some wonderful packages that we offer.
Well, I think it's a winner, and I think everybody should give it a try. Anything we missed, anyone?
We're just looking forward to seeing you. We're inviting you to our home, the Carnegie Inn and Spa.
And we'll be back with more fun after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and I'm going to let you in on a little secret vice of mine, except it's not a vice because it's a very healthy and tasty thing, except I've coveted them for my whole entire life as far as I could remember back. It's called a cactus pear and various other things as well.
Sometimes known as a prickly pear.
Right. But we found the largest producer in America of this treat, and it's Andy Boy is the name of the brand for the pears, and we're interviewing the third generation of the Dorigo family who produces them.
Well, I have a passion, which is not really very new. I've had it for a long time. For some people call them prickly pear cactus fruit. Some people call them pear cactus. In Italy, for some unknown reason, they call them fiche d'India, like figs of India. And we don't know about that. But we're going to ask all these questions and talk even more at length to Margaret Dorigo Martin, who is the third generation in a farm in California, which produces not only the classic fruit, but also variation. Margaret, welcome to On the Menu. I told you before, I just absolutely adore these things.
Well, thank you. We're thrilled.
And you told me that I've been eating one a day, and you told me I was going to be very healthy.
Yes. In fact, a lot of people believe that cactus cures anything, especially diabetes, helps keep diabetes under control. So they are very healthy, and they're very good for you.
Well, the colors are so bright, they have to be a super fruit of sorts, right?
Exactly.
Of course, I never know how many you're supposed to have to eat to get the health benefit.
Well, yeah. I would say if you eat a couple of weeks supplement with other fruits and vegetables, you'd be in good shape.
Really? Because someone in Italy told us he ate three a day.
I can believe it. I think the Italians that are real passionate about them will eat 12 in a sitting with a family of three or four. So that's about correct.
Well, as I told you that I was so tempted because they grow wild everywhere in Sicily when we just got back from Sicily. But I had already learned my lesson when we lived in Australia. I leapt out of the car and grabbed a few, and I could not get the little spiny things out of my skin or even out of my clothes after even washing them. This is one of the problems, right?
Absolutely.
First of all, how did you get into this business? A little history
of your
farm.
According to my father, who's Andy Dorigo, and his family was from Messina, Sicily, and two brothers that started the company came over from there in the early
19... So he's Sicilian.
Sicilian, yes.
Oh, good.
So they came over in the early 1917, 1918 or so to this country, you know, the land of opportunity. And when they got involved in farming, because some of their family was involved in different types of farming, cherries and such, they tended to plant things that were familiar from their country. And cactus pears was one of those type of items, along with fennel and things like that. So that was a very familiar product in their diet, and they were raised on that. So that's something that they wanted to grow out here. And because of the Salinas Valley having these little microclimates that are very special, they were able to plant and produce product right here in this valley.
Now, I'm assuming since it's a cactus, you need a dry climate, right?
It does like a dry climate, so we don't plant them too close to the ocean because there's humidity there. We plant them down the Salinas Valley on the side of the hills where it is drier and where it can get very warm.
Well, now, how many, acres do you have?
Several hundred acres.
Not many.
Which is a lot of cactus. We're actually the largest commercial grower in the United States. So our only competitor really is Mexico of any volume.
How many plants does that translate into, Mark?
Did you ever count? Difficult for me to say. I don't know that. I could certainly get that information for you, but I don't know that off the top of my head.
I'm just interested.
Yeah, if you look at the side of the hill and you see this huge grove, I mean, it just goes on for half a mile. It's a lot of density because the plants are planted very close together as well.
But they also, each one produces a whole bunch of fruit.
They do, yes. They're quite large.
Now, you're doing something interesting, too, that you didn't just plant cactus pears or prickly pears or whatever you call them and then just pick them off and then do the same next year and do the same next year. You've been experimenting with how to make them even more delicious and interesting.
Exactly. We've tried to develop new varieties that are interesting and unique, that have a little bit higher sugar content, different colors. So, and actually, we're in the process, and we have been for many years, of working on a seedless cactus variety. Very slow progress, probably have another 10 years before we get there, but we hope eventually to have a seedless variety as well.
Seedless? My goodness, I think that's half the charm of these things.
Some people love them, but then it is to some, especially we find with younger children, they find the seed a little bit not as special, and I think that's because they're used to eating seedless fruit, this generation.
We're used to seeds. The reason
I
didn't give my husband more, he's now complaining, is because he doesn't like things with seeds. Like,
I mean,
No,
they taste so delicious.
Yes, they are.
I was able to put up with it. But
What's happening is you're cross-pollinating the different varieties. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, we're doing some grafting. So these are actually called hybrids.
Okay.
And we had some plant material brought in out of Mexico, and we have two plant breeders on staff that are PhDs that work exclusively on cactus pear breeding, and then they work on our fennel varieties and our broccoli rabe, which are all our kind of Italian specialty items. So we do a lot of in-house research right here in our facility.
So you do fennel, too. I love fennel.
We do, yes. We develop our own fennel varieties, and we want to have that nice big white bulb that's firm with beautiful fern. And so we do a really good job on that item as well.
They were all over Sicily. They had, what was the city in particular, Peter? They had trucks lined up. The main drag
was I think we saw it in Gela only because it turns out that the main highway in southern Sicily, the notorious SS-113, happens to be a main street in the town of Gela. So obviously when the fennel farmers were coming in to sell their product, that's obviously where they lined their trucks up on the side of the road.
Oh, wonderful.
And they were blemish-free.
Absolutely beautiful white. Looking. And there were probably prickly pears there, too.
There were. I saw them.
So they're selling them in the same way off the back of their truck. Now,
how
do you get rid of all the spines? So
we actually bring ours into a shed, and we have a machine that we had built many, many years ago, and it's very simple. It basically, the pears are dumped in onto a belt, and they go through over a series of rollers which have brushes on them. So that brushes off the spines, and then when they get to the end, we put a light wax over the top that gives them a nice shine and kind of protects the fruit and makes it look a little bit more attractive. And so it's a very, very simple process. But we do brush the spines off.
Picks them, though. Is it by machine?
Actually, it's all picked by hand. It's all hand labor. We have multi-generational families that have been in our farms picking the fruit, and the gentlemen that go out there, because I believe it's primarily gentlemen, they are Tino Hispanic men, and they are dressed fully in leather suits with masks, with gloves, very heavy, almost like leather armor to protect them. And typically what we do is they'll go into the fields early in the morning before any wind picks up, because once the wind comes down the valley, they're kind of in danger of those spines really getting in the air and getting into their skin and such. So
they're almost impossible to get rid of. I mean, they're very fine.
Oh, they're very difficult, yes. Once they get into your skin, they're hard to get out.
This is a very interesting fruit, because, and I guess it's called a fruit correctly. I guess they're calling it a fruit. The most intriguing thing about it, for those people who've seen these in Whole Foods or in supermarkets or in farmers markets, the exterior doesn't do justice to what they're like.
I mean, they really
don't look like there would be anything even very interesting at all to eat. I mean, they just look like a sort of a lump of succulent.
Yes. That's part of one of the challenges is the education part for consumers, because if you're not familiar with it, if you're not from a Mediterranean area or Italian or Hispanic, you typically would see something like that, and we call it kind of ugly. It looks like a hand grenade, the shape of a hand grenade.
It does a little bit, yes.
Not something that people would pick up, but once you cut into it and you see that gorgeous, our main variety is like a magenta inside. It's the most beautiful color, and people are just absolutely shocked by it. And when we take the fruit and puree it and make, whether it's bar drinks out of it or glazes for cheesecakes, different things like that, the color is extraordinary.
You know, I had the purple ones. I had the red ones.
Mm-hmm.
I had the ones, the green, the color of kiwis, and I had yellow ones. Yeah, and the darker the purpley colored, the sweeter the fruit.
Mm-hmm. That definitely has the highest BRICS as far as the sugar content.
Now, what you do is you cut them in half, and then you take a spoon, and you just sort of, it's very easy to lift out the seed part, which is the main fruit.
Yeah, because the seed actually holds the fiber together and holds the fruit. The other way to do it, which makes it real simple, is you slice both ends just in about maybe a quarter of an inch on each end, and then you make a slit down the middle, and then you peel back the outside, and literally the fruit will pop out in one whole piece.
Yeah, oh, it's wonderful.
Oh, wow, there you go. Well, I'd like spoon.
And then you can take that and just slice it into slices and chill it, and it's really has a nice presentation.
And just like spooning it out.
Exactly.
She's a spooner.
Absolutely hooked. Tell me, no, I just eat them plain old. What are some of the other uses for these?
The most common use is to eat it just as a fresh fruit. As I mentioned, a lot of the chefs that we've been working with in the culinary world, either here in Monterey or in Napa or in New York City, as I mentioned, we take the fruit, typically it's small fruit that isn't good enough to go to market and doesn't meet our antiboy specifications, we'll take that and we'll puree it, remove the seeds, and that puree is sold to companies that will make all different kinds of products out of it. And a lot of times it's used for a bar mix, or they'll mix it with lemonade for non-alcoholic application. So it makes a very nice beverage. It also can be used to make a beautiful sorbet, so any kind of a dessert application. It's really quite versatile once you take the fruit out and take the seeds out of it. It's got a lot of different applications.
It'd make one hell of a cosmopolitan, I think.
It does. In fact, we've done prickly pear martinis at some of our galas, and they're amazing.
Now, you mentioned antiboy. This falls under the history of your cup. Explain what that brand refers
to. Yes, antiboy is our brand. So Dorigo Brothers Company is the name of our corporation. And then back in 1927, the Andy Boy brand was created, and basically the little face, the Andy Boy face, is my father, Andrew, who was about 3.5, 4 years old at the time, and his father took a picture of him, and he became the face of the company as our brand. And it's really amazing. I mean, I think consumers have a fascination with it. It's sort of like, you know, Aunt Jemima syrup or different brands like the Betty Crocker, and then you've got Andy Boy. So he became kind of the little face of fresh produce, and we were one of the first produce brands in the market. So it really stuck with people, and I think people really resonate with having a little boy on there, and he's 80, he'll be 88 in a couple of months, and he's still chairman of our board and very actively involved,
really?
With the cactus.
God bless him.
Yeah,
huh?
The cactus pear is actually his pet project. He really loves working with it and been key behind our innovation to get these new varieties, to have seed breeders go to a seedless variety, so he's very passionate about it as well.
This is wonderful stuff, Margaret. We were just so thrilled. I can't remember how Anne found you, but I know she's glad she did, and I'm glad she did too.
Well, we are as well.
Even though I don't get any.
We'll have to send some more.
Yes, send me my own supplies.
We don't want you to go without, for God's sake.
Yeah,
I just didn't think you would want them.
I'll give you a,
excuse.
I'll give you a private address to send them to. So she.
There we go. We'll make sure you get it.
Well, could you just say, is it a growing market? I'm assuming people are finally waking up to how delicious these are.
You know, it is. It's kind of making a little bit of a resurgence. I think, again, it's just keeping it in front of the consumers, you know, advertising it, talking about different ways to use it, drawing them to our website. So we really have to do our end on the consumer advertising part of it to really get people to get excited about it. Once you get it in their mouth, you've got a consumer for life. So it's just getting them, like you say, kind of past the appearance of it and getting them to taste it.
Well, let's sign off with the website, Margaret.
Oh, www.andyboy.com.
Oh, it's andyboy.com. Okay.
Yes.
Well, please give our regards to Mr. Andy, who's not such a little boy anymore. But
not at all. I certainly will.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
Margaret,
thank you both very much. I appreciate it. Take good care.
And I want you to know, listeners, that Anne ate every single one.
I gave you one.
Well, she gave me one. How many were there altogether? I got just exactly one. I couldn't believe she helped herself to one every day. She didn't even offer me a. Didn't even offer me a bite.
You don't like seeds.
I don't like seeds. I really would have liked to have some more. Maybe they'll send us some more. I sure hope so. Anyways, time to move on. Who's up next, dear? I guess we should have said welcome back. That's why I confused you, because you didn't know you were supposed to cue in. Go ahead.
I thought you were going to take a break.
That's right. I forgot. It's that Merry Christmas thing going again. It is time to take a break, and then we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and next up is a treasure. Once again, our friends Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg produced a knockout book called The Food Lover's Guide to Wine, that's getting raves all over the globe just about, and it's on the top of everybody's list. You can use it. Listen here. Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg are a fairly unique couple, and we've had the pleasure of talking to them a number of times over the years. And I would say, Karen and Andrew, I'm really excited for you because you've made it once again a hit, an absolute smashing success in your latest book, which is called The Food Lover's Guide to Wine. Now, you seem to have a knack for tapping into exactly what kind of book is needed. In the sense of, it's almost a reference book, except it's always so friendly and personal.
How did you hit on this?
Well, it's interesting. I think it gets back to our strength as a couple, partnership. Andrew, on personality tests, he comes out as more of the emotional feeling side of the equation. I have an MBA. I'm more in the analytical side of the equation. And I think that it's the two together that become expressed through our books. Through, I think, the structure of the information is always useful, but the stories that are told in the book are always entertaining, and I think we both work really hard to make sure that the books are a balance of both.
Yes, well, Andrew, of course, is trained as a chef, and I didn't know you actually worked as a sommelier?
Actually, we both have trained as a gotten our sommelier certificates from different organizations. And I think it was important to get them eventually, but when we first started writing about wine with our first book, What to Drink with What You Eat, Karen made a point of not actually getting a certificate and being certified as a sommelier because she really wanted to keep a fresh perspective, and I think that really helped a lot in our first book. And then going the next level helped with this book because we did want to delve a little more into wine, a little more into its intricacies, but again, never going too wonky.
So this is book two for you in the wine area.
Yes.
Although we've always written about wine because it's always been an interest of ours, and of course, whenever you write about chefs and restaurants, wine is a topic that will come up. And I think in our second book, Culinary Artistry, we talked with chefs about how they really pulled the two together. One of the questions we asked back then was, you were banished to a desert island for the rest of your life and you could only take 10 ingredients with you, which would you take? And wine was absolutely on that list for chefs.
That would get used up pretty fast if we were in a desert island. Now, just to get an idea of the difference of your approach, I mean, we interviewed Heaven Israeli about his momentous course on wine, the book about the course on wine.
Which is a wonderful book, which we recommend in the Food Lover's Guide to Wine. It's really one of the first great American books on wine by an American author, and Kevin is absolutely terrific. He's really a treasure in our field.
Yeah, we're lucky we have a lot, and some of these sommeliers that you've really interviewed the best of the best in this book.
We've been very fortunate that way of talking to the best sommeliers in America at the very best restaurants, and they all have such a unique perspective, you know, bring something different to it, because the sommeliers in New York City, I think, are much more internationally focused. They serve really wines from around the world, whereas the sommeliers on the West Coast, particularly San Francisco, which is so close to wine country,
right,
they're really focused on serving California wine. So I think it's really important to talk to a broad range of sommeliers because they're all seeing something different in different parts of the country.
But getting back to this comparison, I think that if you explain the difference between like Kevin's book and your book, I think that would give people an idea of the concept behind your current book.
That's a great question, actually. In fact, we told Kevin when we sent him a copy of, we sent him one of the very first copies of our book, and we said we see this as sort of a feeder book for his book, in that his book is the best-selling book on wine in America. It's sold over 3 million copies.
Wow.
All of its different iterations. And it's been coming out in new editions, I think, for the last 25 years. And his book really focuses on the different wine regions. And you kind of go through region by region around the world and exploring different grapes that are grown there, different wines that are made there. And he really does a wonderful job of it. We took a different approach with The Food Lover's Guide to Wine. I wouldn't call it a wine for dummies, another great book, but it's even simpler than that, in that it doesn't ever get too technical. It doesn't assume that you've got a lot of knowledge about wine. It just really takes you into the essentials that anyone who enjoys good food would want to know about wine. So we really do focus on the flavor of wine, what it tastes like. And I think the heart of the book here is really an A to Z guide of more than 250 different styles of wine, which we profile by the name of it, how it's pronounced, the regions where you can find it, the grapes that it's based on, how to serve it, different food pairings, and some of the notable producers that are available. And it's the kind of information that anyone who wants to put a bottle of wine on the table with dinner can really flip through very easily on a daily basis and find something that's perfect.
Now, the other aspect of the book that I thought was interesting is the huge amount of content. I mean, it's hard to believe how you managed to assemble all this information.
That's what they do. That's what always amazes everybody.
You have a distillation of opinions from people whose opinions now should certainly be understood. I mean, if you're a sommelier, then you're in the trenches every day. You're in the trenches dealing with all the issues surrounding a wine. First of all, what's good, what's not so good, what does it go with, and how much does it cost? Because they wrestle with that every single day with every single patron in every single restaurant where they work.
I think the other thing they wrestle with is everyone coming in with a different level of knowledge of
exactly.
wine. And that's the other thing they need to figure out when you're talking to a customer. Hey, the other, you know, sort of 30 seconds at the table to sort of figure out where this person's coming from and how much wine knowledge they have. And that's what we love talking to sommeliers, because they have to go out and speak to every single level of consumer out there. Somebody who's maybe having their first glass of bubbles, someone who's young, or someone who's going for the pairings for the first time, or someone who's going to be a collector. And that's what we love talking to them and sharing their stories and bringing their lives and opinions to our books and sharing them with the people and our readers.
Do you see the London-based magazine Decanter?
Of course.
Yes.
I mean, one of their funniest columns is the one that they have every month, where they ask a sommelier what his favorite wine is, and they also ask him what's the biggest mistake you ever made.
Hilarious. And I
and you get some really funny answers.
Yes, we interviewed Larry Stone, who's considered the king of sommeliers in the United States, the master sommelier, certified both here and in the UK, and he told us once about a wine that was served to a couple that was in celebrating their wedding, and he didn't taste it first, and it turned out that the bottle was horrible, and the couple didn't send it back because they didn't know. And I think, you know, it's a story that's funny, but it also has a really good point that most people are not wine experts, and most people who want to go out and enjoy wine for a special occasion or who just want to enjoy wine at home, they need things simplified for them. They need some guidance. And that's exactly right why we wrote the Food Lover's Guide to Wine, is really to make it simple for people, to simplify a very complicated topic like wine and help people see how they can master the basic principles of it so they can really bring more enjoyment into their life every day.
I thought one of the funniest wine service stories I ever heard, and I can't remember who told us this, it might have been Kevin Israeli or Les Zabraga or somebody like that. And this is a diner who was at Georges Perrier's restaurant in Philadelphia, which is a pretty stuffy establishment. And he was supposed to drink red wine. This patron was supposed to drink red wine, but he wasn't sweet enough. So the sommelier took it back, took the glass back beneath the stairs, and topped it up with Coca-Cola. brought it back. The patron loved it. When they came back to the restaurant, they always ordered the same wine. Wine mixed with Coca-Cola. I mean, it's whatever floats your boat, I guess. It's whatever turns you on. As the patron, as the drinker of the wine, you're the one who needs to be satisfied.
Well, I think that principle is absolutely true, that it's all about you being pleased. And when you go to a restaurant like Le Bernardin, which is one of the most esteemed four-star restaurants in New York City, Aldo Somme.
Oh, I love him.
Isn't he the best?
Oh, yeah.
Was named the World Best Sommelier in 2008. And he says he likes to think of himself as an enjoyment manager. He is there out on the floor. You know, the chefs are back in the kitchen cooking things to please you, but he's there out on the floor wanting to come up with the exact right wine pairings that are going to make your dinner magical. So if more people can learn to think of sommeliers as enjoyment managers, people that they can feel free to just tell them, here's what I like. I prefer white. I prefer red. I prefer dry. I prefer sweet. Whatever the case is. Here's what I'm looking to spend, most importantly, because it really helps to give a sommelier of what your budget is, and they'll help you to find something that's within your budget. And there's the old stereotype of sommeliers trying to push a much more expensive wine down your throat. That really isn't the case anymore, not with the most reputable restaurants and sommeliers. So I think if people learn to confide in them and really share what they're looking for, they can be very pleasantly surprised when they're out for dinner.
Now, how important is the goes with aspect of this? It seems to me that that's really critically important, and it's one of the reasons that we frequently turn over wine selections to the sommelier and say, would you please pour the things that you think go with the dishes that chef is going to send out. Frequently, there are dishes that we haven't had before either. So the secret is to get the right goes with.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. We're absolutely in that camp. And I think if there is someone on the floor who can do pairings for you, absolutely go with it. Because, again, certainly in the top restaurants, you're just not going to be familiar with a lot of these dishes. I mean, although we were at Danielle one time, and the maitre d' was joking that we have people come in two or three times a week to eat at Danielle. We're not in that category. So unless you really know the food, you do need some guidance. And even if it's not a four-star restaurant or a three-star restaurant, and a more casual place, just ask for whoever knows the most about the wine list. It might be a manager or someone or a waiter who's very into wine. So don't hesitate to ask for some help. I think it's always going to serve you.
Well, the other issue, of course, is you also won't know many of the wines that are on their list. So how are you supposed to pick one anyway?
That's exactly right.
Well said.
And we are constantly, even as so-called quote-unquote wine experts, we're constantly putting ourselves into the hands of the local sommelier to do exactly that.
Now, how many sommeliers did you interview?
Boy, I think we interviewed over 30 sommeliers all around the country for this book. And then we also did a lot of our own research nets.
Uh-huh.
But we just love talking to, you need to spend your day talking to the best sommeliers or even the best chefs in the country about wine and food. It's a good day, let me tell you.
Yeah,
nice. Fun to share these stories and give people this advice.
And I think what's really wonderful is seeing how many of them are just the traditional stereotype of the French male, but really women who have mastered wine, who are just bringing a new level.
There's a huge increase, isn't there? Yeah, of women in wine. Hmm?
Yes, there's a lot of great women on the floor.
How many do you have in this book?
Probably nearly 50%, if not 50%.
That's really great.
Male sommeliers, including Belinda Chang.
Oh, she's fabulous.
At that point was at the Modern and just won.
Yeah, where is she now?
She's now at Monkey Bar in New York City.
Oh, okay.
And she's doing a great job there. They just brought in a new chef, and she's redoing the wine program and teaching all the staff about wine. So it's really moving forward in a really positive, great way.
It's, you know, I forget what section of Spain it was. We went to some sort of seminar and learned that in that region, more than 50% of the winemakers were women.
There's a lot more winemaker competition that celebrates the best of women-made wine. And they do tend to pull in, I don't know if it's exclusively all women judges, but a great number of women judges in that competition as well. So it's a nice way to showcase what they're doing.
The region Anne was referring to is the region of Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E.
Yes.
And we interviewed the president of the Wine Association of Navarre, who, as it happens, is also a woman. So, and there are a lot of excellent and an even larger number of women winemakers. We did think it was intriguing. We interviewed Eileen Crane. She recounted how she got her first job as a winemaker.
She's lovely.
She is.
Loved having a tasting with her the other month and tasted through several vintages of her most recent sparkling wines. And it's really spectacular. I think if you had blind tasted us, we would have been hard-pressed to tell whether these were California sparkling wines or wines from Champagne itself. But Eileen Crane is, I think, one of the best
and
winemakers in America, period, let alone women winemakers.
Well, she pointed out, however, that she still does not make in salary the equivalent of their male counterparts.
Isn't that interesting?
Wow.
She volunteered this. I didn't ask.
She's probably not necessarily a good negotiator. I think she felt like she was really just pleased to get the job, and it was a wonderful job that she got, and she does it so well, I don't think money's really the object. She's more interested in things like the, who are the owners? Monsieur Tattinger? Monsieur Tattinger served one of her sparkling wines on the eve of the fake millennium, 12/31/99.
Because of the fake
millennium.
So there's no, I think that's the kind of thing that she's interested in. To complete the story, I think that she was succeeded in getting a job because some wine owner, vineyard owner somewhere called up and said, the professor of her class at UC Davis and said, do you have any candidates for me? And he said, I only have women, and you wouldn't be interested in that, would you?
Oh, my God.
Those are fighting words.
Thank God times have changed.
Yeah.
Well, now, Sir Domaine Carneros never looks back in hiring her. It was a wonderful
experience. Indeed. Now, Karen and Andrew, I've always wanted to ask you this, and we've touched on this a little bit in the interview. Like, how much did you know going into your subject, and like, how much did you learn, and what are some of the things that you learned that you didn't know beforehand?
That's a wonderful question, Anne. Funny, because every time before we start a book, of course, we write a proposal, and we lay out what we believe the chapters are going to be. And I think in every single case, for every single book we've ever written, the final chapters tend to be dramatically different from what we think they're going to be going in, because we learn so much over the course of doing our research for every book. We really speak to dozens of the best experts we can find on the topic we're researching, and through that process, we don't like to be limited by the structure that we've set out for ourselves in advance. We really like to be open to what we're learning and go down nooks and crannies of research so that we can incorporate them into the final book. I would say first book, we proposed 10 chapters, and Becoming a Chef had maybe 4 of the same chapters that we'd originally proposed.
Oh, wow.
The rest of the book was completely different. I think with the Food Lover's Guide to Wine, we had a much better idea of what we were going to write, but still the structure of the book changed dramatically. We knew we wanted a book that would appeal to both beginners, intermediates, and advanced wine enthusiasts. And it's a pretty tall order. I thought we were going to be a little more structured about it, but in truth, I think the subject really unfolded in kind of a chronological way. We really wanted to start by looking at history, the history of wine in America, and we did focus on America as opposed to the world, because I think sometimes it gets a little esoteric when you start talking about the history of wine and going back 4,000, 5,000 years in the Middle East, and people's eyes start to glaze over. You know, it's so ancient that they can't even identify with it. But when you start by looking at the United States history and how the original settlers who came to Jamestown were commanded by the king to grow grapevines because they wanted to start a wine industry, you see how the history of wine in America really parallels the history of the United States itself.
And yes.
People take a much greater interest in that.
No, I thought that was a brilliant piece in the book.
I think one of the things I loved learning about wasn't necessarily about wine, but was the sommelier's humble beginnings. I loved finding out that one of the sommelier's parents drank only white Zinfandel out of the box at home. And a French sommelier went home to tell his parents, you know, mother, father, I'm going to be a sommelier. And they looked at him and they said, what's that? He was a sommelier because he was from Brittany where they drank cider. I think what I love about that is it lets everyone know that we all start someplace. And, you know, as long as you're pouring a glass of wine, God bless you. We want to help you come to the table and drink more wine. But I love knowing that everyone else had sort of humble beginnings, much like, you know, I did growing up with my parents drinking jug wine at home.
Well, I think that's wonderful. I grew up with parents who kept a bottle of sherry in the cupboard, I think just in case they got news of anybody who died.
It was really sherry.
So I think the wonderful thing about this couple that we've just been interviewing is I know there's going to be another book. That's a definite. What I'm waiting for is the next book about wine so I can find out what I still don't know.
Well, you know, there's so much we don't know about wine, and in fact, we still learn something new about wine every single day. After we put The Food Lover's Guide to Wine to bed, and we had realized that we'd recommended that certain wines be drunk young and fresh, we had an instance over this past summer that we were served a particular wine. It turned out to be a 30-year-old Moscato d'Asti that we had recommended be drunk young and fresh. And
we completely
turned our minds around to the fact that if something is a quality wine, as this Vietti Moscato d'Asti was, it can have a long life. And if you store it well, you can enjoy it a long time later. So I think it's great for us to still be learning new things about wine every day, whether it's being introduced to a new grape or a new producer, or, you know, discovering that a wine can last much longer than we ever dreamed it could. Part of the joy of wine is that you never really learn at all.
Well, it's a book to savor, just like a good glass of wine. It's not quite early enough in the day for us to have one yet, but I'm sure you may be sure that we'll think of you as we pour what it is we're going to have this evening. I haven't decided what it is yet.
You mean it's not quite late enough?
Not quite soon enough. Did I say late enough?
No, you didn't.
I said soon enough. Well, I must be yearning for a glass of wine, so let me rush up and get one. Thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you for another addition to our food and wine reference library.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Cheers.
Thanks, Karen and Andrew.
And we'll be back with more wine-related stuff right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are, and next we're not trying to be scandalous here, because when we say naked here in the terms of naked grape, we mean natural, and we've got somebody who can really explain the whole thing to us, a dear, dear woman called Alice Fearing.
Alice Fearing has the wrong last name. It should be
Fearless.
Alice Fearless, yes, or something like that, or Alice Lawless.
Well, it is actually pronounced Fearing.
It's pronounced Fearing, okay.
Well, that's better,
well,
isn't it?
Well, yourself... You're certainly not afraid. So the last time we talked a couple of years ago, you were just announcing to the world, documenting that you had taken on the Emperor of Wine, one Robert Parker, and succeeded in deflecting him from the awful things that he was doing. So now you decided you would throw your hat in another ring called Natural Wine. Now, we're going to come back in just a second, talk about what Natural Wine is and isn't, because it takes a little while to cotton on to exactly what's included and what's not. But first question, why now? Why a Natural Wine book? Now.
Well, now is when it came out, but when I first sold the idea for the book was probably 2010, and I started to think about writing it at the end of 2009. What happened in 2009, so I had already made the wine that I talk about in the beginning of the book. That had already been released. But what started happening is that people all over the country started arguing about the term natural wine. What is it? If there's natural wine, that means there has to be unnatural wine. And there started to be these natural wine weeks around the country. And a lot of winemakers who were participating were absolutely not natural. And so I realized that this was the word natural, and natural wine was going to be co-opted, and it was going to be used as a marketing term, whether I liked it or not. So I felt that there needed to be a book that actually gave it a place in history, lay down some guidelines, and basically, all right, guys, you're going to be making what you call natural wine, but know that this is part of a bigger movement with people a lot more pure than you are. And I stitched together two stories to write the book.
Well, now there was another event that got you interested in natural wine that you reference in the book, although it really kind of had a sad ending, because somebody got in touch with you from Oregon and said, I have some grapes for you, Alice. Come and make some wine.
Yeah, so I guess the whole story of how I made this book is very complicated. When my first book came out, The Battle for Wine and Love, I got a call from David Letson, Jason, who I know in Oregon, and he said, I was talking to Dad, and we think it's time that you made your own wine according to your own principles. And
now, tell me how you spell this. Is this the, this is not Lights Culinary.
No, this is L-E-T-T, and the winery is called Airy, E-Y-R-I-E.
I know the winery. Okay.
And it's in Oregon. It's a fine winery in Oregon.
Yeah, it's wonderful, wonderful, and they've always been organic from the very beginning. It was David Lett who brought Pinot Noir to Oregon. He really was the guy that started it all. And according to my principles, I didn't call it natural wine. It was what I wrote about in the other book, was really wine that had nothing added and nothing taken away. And I was in a panic. I didn't really want to make my own wine, but I thought about it. I thought, well, how I'd learned so much. It'd be really fabulous. And maybe I would see that it was really difficult to make wine naturally. Maybe I'd have to change my whole tune. As it turns out, because I am a writer and I am a journalist, I pitched it to the New York Times, and they said, great, blog about it for us, please. And also, as it turns out, I couldn't go to do it in Oregon because David was in his last few months of being on this earth, and it was the wrong time.
Oh,
and
wow.
It was really, I'm not close to the family, and it was wrong to be there at his last vintage. So a friend of mine said, well, you know, Alice, we have grapes here in California.
Right, right. So now you find yourself in California,
right.
And I think you were giving a speech or something like that, and then somebody came up to you and said, you really ought to put something where your mouth is.
Well, it was, but I did such those things earlier. I had history in Healdsburg. It's where I did one of my first readings for the book, and some people there didn't like me too much. So I was going back to Healdsburg, where I also had some very good friends, and also some people who weren't too crazy about my feeling about California wine. And ironically, I made wine in California, a state whose wines I have taken to task.
And it's really interesting, because you chose a grape which is rare in the world in general, and certainly rare in California.
Yeah.
And curiously enough, we've actually drunk it in Italy. Anne probably can't remember, but we drank a wine from Montefalco made out of a grape called Sagrantino, and we said, boy, this is really good.
Yes.
Why can't we find more of it? And the answer is, unfortunately, you can't find a lot of it. But
yeah.
You found someone who was growing it in California.
Right, and he was crazy about Montefalco wine as well, and he also makes olive oil, and so he wanted to try Sagrantino. And so he had some grapes, said, all right, give it a shot, use mine. So I really made the wine for him, and he let me do what I wanted to do.
Oh, I see. Okay. And he's actually, and he's selling it on the market for a pretty good price, too.
Yeah, for a very good price. He sells it under the name of Davero, D-A-V-E-R-O.
And you stomped all of this, huh?
I stomped all of it. I stomped, and I...
She really did.
I did.
she got a little New York body in some old clothes and got on the wine and stepped. What's the word for it? It's paillage or something like that.
Paillage, yeah, all the way up to the end of fermentation every day.
Wow.
Amazing thing
did
to do.
Did you enjoy it, Alice?
I did enjoy it, but I would never really want to make wine again unless I grew my own grape. I don't see this. It seems very boring. If you're in touch with growing grapes all year round, if you're part of the seasons, then it makes sense. Take all that gestalt and put it into a bottle of wine. But just to buy grapes doesn't really appeal to me.
So it's sort of almost like an anticlimax in a way.
Yeah.
But then you started to explore what it was like to make wine. I mean, you discussed making wine and how people are treating it as a chemical process rather than a natural process at UC Davis and other places.
Exactly.
In your last book, and you were very critical of that. But now you started to discover with natural wines that in fact, you really have an enormous dilemma because you can make a natural wine just fine, but you also might have created an explosive, like a Molotov cocktail.
Yeah, so my wine was perfectly fine, really actually delicious, and the thing about making a natural wine, I wasn't making a huge quantity. I was working with a ton and a half of grapes. And when you're working in small containers, it is very easy to work naturally. It's a little bit more difficult, needs more skill if you're doing giant tanks the way people do in California. But I know a lot of people who do small lot fermentation and make a fair amount of wine, and it's all about dedication. And it was very interesting being in California, seeing what everybody else was doing to their wine, seeing just how many of the 200 approved additives are used.
That's really scary.
Let's talk about a couple of things, which I thought you covered very, very well in the book. The first is the distinction between organic wine, natural wine, and biodynamic wine.
Let's get those definitions out there.
Go ahead and take
a crack. Okay, I'm going to take it on. Okay, organic wine, okay, that's predicated on organic viticulture. It's still a chemical model, but nothing really harmful. No artificial chemicals are added to the soil. Then they keep on changing their laws about what it to have organic wine, but now you are allowed, they're voting on, I think right now, whether you're going to be allowed to use sulfur. That has always been the breaking point. And I believe that it is out of the next vintage or maybe even this vintage, the United States will be able to use sulfur in their wine. You're also allowed to use any additive as long as it is organic.
Okay.
And that's very different. So you can use yeast, you can use tannin, you can use all sorts of enzymes as long as it is organic. Now, biodynamic wine might be the closest we have to certification for natural wine. So there are some differences. So biodynamic viticulture, which is based on 9 preparations that come from animal, mineral, or vegetable, absolutely no chemical involved, and it is also based on timing your vineyard practices.
Right. The phases of the moon.
Got it. But biodynamic is more about managing the soil.
Yes.
That it is managing the grapes themselves.
Yes, but there are, yeah, that's absolutely true, managing the soil, but there are treatments that you're going to be spraying on the leaf because you need to do your vine management.
Oh, okay, so there's a little bit of that going on too.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. But so the soil, the preparations during the winter and the preparations during the summer and the growing process will deal with the leaves. So you're going to spray silica on the leaves, things like that.
Okay.
Make it to help it absorb more sun, so to help photosynthesis. And you'll be pruning your vines in the winter according to the phase of the moon, that kind of thing.
Got it. Okay, now...
You don't have to be naked, though, right?
No, you don't. You don't. Some people are, but no, you don't. So there is a certified process for... Demeter certifies biodynamic wine, oversees the winemaking. And there are several different categories of biodynamic practices.
Right, okay.
For the most part, you're not allowed to yeast, you're not allowed to really add anything but sulfur. And I think they lost the battle on irrigation, and it is low sulfur, 100 parts per million. we do the same as organic wine. But you're allowed to add fewer things to the wine.
Natural wine is different again.
Different again. So you have at least organic viticulture. So you're either organic or biodynamic.
Got it.
And you have this goal of making a wine with nothing added and nothing taken away.
Okay.
So you're not adding anything, even salt.
Okay, although that's an issue of, I guess, debate and concern all the time. And you discovered, I don't know if you knew all these people already, but you discovered natural winemakers all over the planet, including a great many of them in France, which is not exactly the place you'd expect to find them, is it, really?
Well, it is where it started. I was more surprised to find how many are springing up in Spain, because that's new. At least France has been doing this since the late 70s, even though in the past 10 years it's grown exponentially.
Okay, so France is a country that grows a lot of wine.
Yeah.
So it's really not surprising, I guess, that there's a lot of natural wine. But in a way, it seems kind of a non-French thing to do, don't you think?
Why?
It just seems like the French have always done it the same way. They don't like to change doing anything.
Ah, I see. Well, you know, like it wasn't until the 70s that things started to change. So in a way, it's really returning to the way things have always been.
Okay, all
right. In the 70s, chemical viticulture came into France. Some people never went over, but a lot of people did. And with all this other stuff, people are going, huh, why did we change again?
Yeah, tell me again why it seemed like such a good idea, right?
Yes, exactly.
Now, in the natural wine movement, is it no sulfur or just a very smallest amount you can get away with?
It depends. It really depends on the vintage.
Okay.
What you need to make wine without sulfur is a beautiful harvest. Very, very clean, healthy, wonderful grapes. If you are in danger of some rot, if you have a rainy harvest, if you've had problematic harvest, it probably would be prudent to add some, maybe at the very beginning of fermentation, or maybe just at bottling. But the aim is mostly to go through the whole fermentation process without it. So it really is a philosophy rather than rules.
And that's where your heart is?
Yes, that's where my heart is. And that's what I want to drink more and more, because it's not about that I love the philosophy, which of course I do, but I just find the wines made this way have so much more interest and life.
Really?
Huh. Yeah, vibrant.
Yeah, I mean, they're not trying to be something else. I guess the thing you were, I remember, the thing that you really ranted about in your last book was that people could make wine taste like just about it. No, they could take just any old grapes and make them taste pretty good.
Yes.
And you were really offended by that, and I can understand why you'd be offended by that, and it convinced me I should be offended by it too. So that California Davis leads the world in winemaking is somehow not something we should be perhaps quite as proud of.
Yes.
We should be thinking about the wonderful French characters that you met.
And there's some really wonderful characters that I did meet. And there's, when you think of it, it's a conventional wine is made for a market, and a natural wine really is just dealing with what nature gave you that year and just transporting it into a bottle. And that's the kind of thing that gets me mostly excited.
Do you find any value in biodynamic systems at all?
Do I? Well, yes, absolutely. I find that it makes people way more aware of their soil and their land.
Mm-hmm. That's what we think, too, yeah.
And that comes out in the wine. It's a very different relationship with the land. And do I believe in it? Well, I don't know. But I do know that I have had a phenomenal amount of fantastic biodynamic wines.
Good. So there's something in it.
There's got to be something in it.
And, of course, just what you said, we interviewed how many people who said that the biodynamic approach saved their vineyards. And why wouldn't it if it takes you into closer contact with your soil?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it makes a whole lot of sense. Now, I can't do justice to this book, Alison, because you have so much wonderful detail that's included here. But listeners, if you're interested in really getting to understand wines at a deeper level than just tasting them and enjoying them. This, just like your previous book, is a great one to do that, and I can't wait for the next one. I don't know what it's about, but I'm sure I'm going to be fascinated with it when it comes out.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you.
Let's mention again, it's called Naked Wine, which is self-explanatory. Letting Grapes Do What Comes Naturally by Alice Firing.
Alice is firing on all cylinders and fears no one.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. my mother a few years ago said, maybe we should just give up and change the spelling of our name.
Oh, really?
You know, and then I changed the name of my website to The Firing Line, thinking, okay.
Oh, that would make, yeah, notice.
Well, Alice, once again.
But whatever you call me, I'll answer. It's fine.
Well, thank you for your contribution to the wonderful world of wine literature, and it was a delight to talk to you, and I hope we'll have the occasion to talk to you again in another couple of years when you've done something else exciting.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Alice.
So Feliz Navidad, and that's a clue. That's a clue for where we are today.
What we're saying,
Buon Natale.
Buon Natale.
And Merry Christmas to all of you around the world. We're so glad you're part of the On the Menu family and that you chose to spend this part of your day with us. And we'll see you same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.